In our sermon text today, Hebrews 1, 1 to 4, we pause in preaching through the Psalms for our Advent series, these first several chapters in Hebrews. Today, Hebrews 1, 1 to 4. Long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, He has spoken to us by His Son, whom He appointed the heir of all things, through whom also He created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of His nature. And He upholds the universe by the word of His power. After making purification for sins, He sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high, having become as much superior to angels as the name He has inherited is more excellent than theirs. God has spoken. He is not silent, is He? One of my most valuable courses in seminary at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School was my counseling course, where I learned, among other things, how people communicate non-verbally. We communicate non-verbally, don't we? Those of you listening to this can't see what I'm doing, but if I yawn in the pulpit, how might I expect you to be excited about my sermon, right? If I'm yawning in the middle of it, when I see you yawn, sometimes it's tempting for me to yawn too. We communicate non-verbally, don't we? You guys communicate to me as I communicate to you as well. I see your expressions and your body language and posture and stuff. I was taught 8 means of nonverbal communication. There is facial expression. Consider how expressions of fear or happiness, sadness, and anger, what they communicate, how we communicate with our face. They do so across time and culture too, don't they? Gestures too. Our hand and our body movements tell us much. I was always told to coordinate those in my preaching. To do things like this. God loves you. Shaking your fist at the congregation. Well, it's not a good combination, is it? I pastored a largely Italian congregation. I've told you many anecdotes from that. But boy, I learned to gesticulate. Italians gesticulate broadly, don't they? They speak almost as much with their hands and their gestures as with their words. That's different in an Oriental culture, isn't it? Oriental cultures prize restraint and modesty and humility, and so their body language is not as exaggerated. Well, there are paralinguistics, too. We communicate via paralinguistics. That's a technical term that refers to what we call the tone of voice. Think of how volume, inflection, pitch all contribute to what you mean to say. I can tell my kids, come here right now. I can tell my wife, come here right now. It's the same words, isn't it? But there are paralinguistics involved in the tone of voice, if you will. Body language and posture also communicate. How many times did your parents say to you, don't slouch in your chair? It's rude. Sit up straight. Things like arm crossing, leg crossing, open arms tell us a lot about what we're thinking and feeling. Oh, I like this one. Proxemics. That's a nice fancy term for how close you are to people. Proxemics. Personal space. We require a certain distance or proximity to express ourselves. When we want to say a new acquaintance, we need 2 to 4 feet of separation. When we want to say beloved friend, it might be a foot or to a hug, right? Our requirements vary depending on our circumstances. Personal space is different on a New York subway, isn't it, than it is on the hiking trail? There is also eye gaze. The old adage, the eye is a window to the soul, is spot on, isn't it? Looking, staring, blinking, say things to others as we communicate with them. Then there is also haptics. a lot of technical terms for stuff we do and know already. Haptics, it has to do with touch. A recent study demonstrated the need of infants, for example, for close, intimate touch by the mother, especially during those first 6 months of life. We communicate affection, familiarity, sympathy, other emotions, and how we touch others. And then there is appearance as well, number 8, appearance. Our choice of color, clothing, hairstyles, hygiene affect what we communicate to others. My uncle always ingrained in me as a young man growing up. He said, Dave, clothes make the man. He was a salesman, so he had to dress sharp. And we communicate by how we dress, our hairstyles, hygiene, all of these things. Well, think then of all the ways that we communicate. How we speak, if you will. Now stop and think of how God has communicated to us. Ask yourself, if I had wanted to discover who God is and what He intends, what must I read? What must I listen to? If He had not chosen to speak to us in the way that He has, would any amount of application of the 8 means open up access to Him? Would it? Now, pagan religions have presumed to do some of these things with practices like divination, speaking in tongues, reading various signs, everything from bones and stars to tea leaves, right? All to no avail. Does that mean then that God is silent? Let's look to our text today, shall we? As we open up this first text in our Advent series, speak. Point number 1, God is not silent, but has spoken by His prophets in various periods and by various means. These first several chapters of Hebrews serve as an excellent subject for Advent for a number of reasons, but not the least of which is that God the Father chose to reveal Himself within the time-space matrix of redemptive history in a man, Christ Jesus. The man of His own choosing in the time and place of His own choosing. And what makes Hebrews so appropriate is the author of Hebrews, and more on him momentarily, he dwells upon this topic to make his argument to his audience, that is, to Hebrew Christians who are under great temptation, great pressure to return from the new covenant ordinances and teachings to the old covenant ordinances and teachings, with which they're so lovingly familiar. That is the burden of the letter of the Hebrews to its audience. And the strident, emphatic argument throughout Hebrews is no, the old covenant is inferior to the new covenant. Christ is superior to Moses. Melchizedek, he's superior to Melchizedek or the angels, any other to whom he may be compared. The heavenly realities Christ has inaugurated are far superior to the mere earthly types and shadows instituted by Moses, and temple, sacrifice, and festival. So we see a comparison and a contrast throughout Hebrews that productively illustrates Christ's advent. Others came and spoke to us provisionally before, truly, certainly, from God, yes. But Christ now has come and spoken to us fully and finally, now. And this is established for us in these opening verses. What is the subject predicate of this opening sentence in this book? It's a complex sentence, so it's not always easy to identify. When I taught our kids language, Hebrew and Greek and Latin, I told them, first find the subject predicate. Subject predicate of this sentence is God spoke. God spoke. There are opening qualifiers long ago, that is from time immemorial, and at many times. Note the prophets, just as you thumb through your Old Testament. We read from one of them today, talking about his speaking forth, right? The prophets, the direct revelations in redemptive history. And in many ways, a spoken word to a prophet, a theophany at Sinai, a Christophany to Abraham at Sodom and Gomorrah, pillars of fire, pillars of smoke at the Red Sea. In many ways, God spoke, didn't he? And we must not pass over the significance of this truth. God spoke. We live in a culture where people are deaf to God, are they not? And rightly so, because they're dead in their sins and therefore deaf to God. When God is silent, we see what the fallen imagination of man concocts to serve as a so-called voice from God. The Devereaux have been sending me some great contacts here on Islam and its background and its dangers to us. The demonic jinn of Islam. You know, a genie is a genie in a bottle. We play with that a little bit, but it's a demon is what it is. A jinn, a spirit, a demonic spirit speaking to Muhammad in a cave. That's how he got his revelation. Or the 8 million gods of Hinduism, each with a voice from hell. Zeus and the panoply of gods emanating from Olympus and the Greek panoply of gods, one more decadent and capricious than the next. This is what the human imagination concocts when God is silent or when we are deaf. That's really more the characterization, isn't it? We are deaf as fallen men and women. We have God screaming, speaking to us all around us in nature, but our sinful hearts suppress that truth, do they not? But fortunately, he is not silent, is he? I'm on a Francis Schaeffer kick here recently. He is there. God is there, and he is not silent, is he? Schaeffer says, the infinite personal God. He chooses his words very carefully. His titles he chooses very carefully to minister to the contemporary lost man and woman. He says, the infinite personal God, the God who is Trinity, has spoken. He is there and he is not silent. Think of that for a moment. If God had chosen to remain silent and not give us special revelation, what would we know? What would we know that is true about him? Paul observes in the first chapter of Romans, by our unrighteousness, we suppress the truth. When we see it all around us in nature. Indeed, as Paul says, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. But we, in our unrighteousness, our fallen state, our fallen nature, by nature, we distort what we receive in natural revelation. We're like a warped cue ball. We never roll in the direction we would otherwise be struck. We're always off course by nature. In high school, I had a friend whose dad had an excellent pool table. And we used to go over there all the time. But he had a trick cue ball, that he put out on the table for newbies who would come over for the first time. They'd strike that ball and go wobbling all over the table. And that's us. When it comes to natural revelation, we've got it all around us like pool balls all around us, but we're built in off course. This is why if God is going to communicate true truth, once again, that's Schaeffer. Schaeffer says there's truth all around us and scientists perhaps achieve a measure of discerning truth, but true truth, if we can be redundant about it, if we're going to communicate true truth, then he is going to have to choose to do it himself. Schaeffer says, there is no use having a silent God. We would not know anything about him, unquote. Thus God reaches down from heaven and communicates to us long ago at many times and in many ways, speaking to our fathers by the prophets. Now this would be review for Apollos' audience. And I posit I won't die on this hill. Others have posited the Apostle Paul, of course, the most popular as the author. Barnabas, some have said, authored the book of Hebrews. My own characterization is Apollos, because indeed Apollos was an eloquent man, well-versed in the Scriptures, as Paul tells us in, or as Luke tells us in the book of Acts. And he was able to reason with fellow Jews, fellow expatriate Jews, reason with them very carefully and very closely. Under the tutelage of the Apostle Paul and Aquila and Priscilla as well. So all of this then would be review for Apollos' audience, Hebrew Christians who would be familiar with the Septuagint, which he cites freely in his work. What is the Septuagint? It is a translation of the Hebrew Bible into what language? Into Greek. The modern, if he's not an atheist or an agnostic for whom the universe is silent, the modern is listening to a host of babbling voices which are not the voice of God. So this would not be review for us or for them. So we must, in our apologetics, we must begin a step or two back. That is, establish that God has spoken. He is not silent. Schaeffer is very passionate about this. He says, he is not silent. The reason we have the answer, he's talking to Christians here, the reason we have the answer is because the infinite personal God, the full Trinitarian God, has not been silent. He has told us who he is. Couch your concept of inspiration and revelation in these terms, and you will see how it cuts down into the warp and woof of modern thinking. He is not silent. Unquote. And of course, at Labrie, Schaeffer had shoe leather experience with this, did he not? He appealed to the intellectual, the academic, if you will. Schaeffer, just go preach the simple gospel, is what he was told so many times. He said, I got tired of hearing that. He said, the gospel is simple to the person who understands it. And the academic, the intellectual, does not understand it until you couch it in his world and in his terms. Make it appeal to his worldview. Well then, if this be true, if God is not silent, then what is the more recent way he has spoken? If not by the prophets, so long ago. That brings us to point two. Point two, speak. God is not silent, but has spoken by his Son in these last days, by his life and sacrifice, verses 2-4. Very eloquent, very densely packed section, this. God has not only spoken recently, but he has spoken finally, too. And the author of Hebrews will unpack this throughout his work, but he begins that work here. He has spoken fully and finally at his first advent. He spoke loudly by sending his Son, did he not? Those of you in our Wednesday night Bible study, where we are looking at eschatology, we looked at this very text, as a matter of fact. What is significant about in these last days? In these last days, plural. They are, as Dr. Holcomb demonstrates, indicative of the new age, the new aeon, the new eon that Christ has inaugurated. Without fail, across the board, when this, you see this term, the last days, when they're spoken of in the plural, the writer is speaking of that age inaugurated by Christ at his first advent. So significant was it that it was indeed a new age, a new eon. We should take that term back. Take it back from the new agers. Because there really was only one new age, and that is when Christ came and inaugurated this aeon, this eon. And then when the Bible speaks in the singular, the last day, that author is speaking of the regeneration of all things in the final day when Christ returns at his second advent. So when you see this term, the last days, in the plural, talking about the age in which we live, moving linearly in time towards the end. And when you see the last day, it's talking about that final day when Christ returns at his second advent. And the authors of the New Testament employ these terms universally. So, in the old aeon, under the old covenant, God spoke by the prophets. Now he has spoken by his son, Jesus of Nazareth, this fully human, fully divine person, Jesus of Nazareth, who is the Christ. And now he begins his argument for the finality of that declaration by unfolding six things about him. Now you have those there before you. Some put seven. I have you with six. That make him the highest voice possible, the voice of God himself. A, under two. God has declared Christ heir of all things. Once again, as we've shown in our eschatology class, inheritance is a vital part of the ancient world, more so even than in our own day. It's bound up with family and place and role in the world in which the ancient lived. The rule of primogeniture dictated that the eldest, the first son, receive the larger portion, or perhaps the whole portion in some cultures. And here we see indeed Christ, as God's only son, becomes heir of all things, with profound implications throughout the New Testament too. Your interpretation of the book of Revelation should be guided by this, because Revelation is an unveiling of the seven-sealed covenant or will or bequest of the Father to the Son. And if you don't understand that Christ is opening his will and taking his inheritance, taking his possession, then you won't understand the book of Revelation. And then not only Jews but Gentiles too, another theme throughout the New Testament, the Gentiles are now heirs. This mystery is that Gentiles are fellow heirs, Paul says, members of the same body, partakers of the promise in Christ Jesus through the gospel. And then, in fact, all believers are co-heirs with this son. Paul so eloquently, if we're children, we're heirs, heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ, provided we suffer with him in order that we may also be glorified with him, Paul says. So, God has declared Christ heir of all things. He, a son by nature, we sons by adoption. You can see why, if indeed this is a polish, you can see why he leads with this assertion. It's not the only one, is it? B, under two. God has made all things through him. The Creator has rights over what he makes. That's inherent in this, isn't it? The potter has rights over the clay in which he shapes and forms. My wife is taking a pottery class, so I hear of her experiences with clay and things all the time. I have this vision of suddenly our whole premises being taken over by pottery wheels and clay and stuff like that. But she assures me that's not the case. But she has rights over what she makes. She tosses a lot in the pile. The conclusion is that implicitly, he is superior to all he has made, too. As creator of all things made through him. We saw this in our first chapter of John here today as well. And there are implications here as well for Christ's deity and his oneness with the Father, too. This was a text that was at the elbow of those at the Council of Nicaea in AD 325 as well, because it has profound implications, profound statements, revelations of who Christ is and his very nature. Dr. Hughes, for example, says, the implication of the doctrine, that is, of Christ creating the world, here and elsewhere, is the priority of Christ to the whole created order, and therefore his preexistence and coexistence with the Father, unquote. Implication of Christ having, God having made all things through him. Athanasius, read your history of the Nicene Creed, the formation of the Nicene Creed. You'll see the one towering hero of Orthodoxy there was St. Athanasius. And he says about this text, when the sacred writers say that he is before all ages and that through him he created the world, they proclaim the eternal and everlasting being of the Son and thereby designate him as God. And our author will build upon this truth in chapters to come as well. But it's not all he says about him here, is it? C, under two. God has expressed his nature and glory through him as well. God has expressed his nature and glory through him. And you see at his first advent, this dawning on people, right? He had no physical appearance that we might admire him, Isaiah says, but people, as they began to see the life lived of Christ, it began to dawn on them. This is no mortal man. And here we return. Christ has expressed his nature and glory through him. We return to that Old Testament theme of the sublime expression of God's glory, the Shekinah of God himself, the Shekinah glory of God himself. Resident now in this one at his first advent. People began to see it after a while, did they not? As John says so boldly, we beheld his glory. The glory is as of the Father. The Shekinah glory, we see it in Exodus, for example. Moses went up on the mountain and the cloud covered the mountain. The glory of the Lord dwelt on Mount Sinai. That's the Shekinah glory. The cloud covered it 6 days. The appearance of the glory of the Lord to Moses was like a devouring fire on the top of the mountain in the sight of the people of Israel. And this glory, our text here is declaring that this glory, this Shekinah glory, is Christ's property. It is a property of Christ himself. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. We have seen his glory. Glory is of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. His disciples caught a glimpse, did they not, on the Mount of Transfiguration? This is the glory, the Shekinah glory. After 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up on a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. And his clothes became radiant, intensely white, as no one on earth could bleach them, i.e. the Shekinah glory, a property of the Son, shared with the Father. Trinitarian implications here. Once again, Athanasius. At one point in the formation of the Nicene Creed, he was the only one who stood and said, no compromise. We are not going to compromise the declaration of the text on Christ's nature. He is fully God and as well as fully man, and we're not going to compromise the language of this confession to accommodate anything else. He was persecuted. He was dislodged from his pastorate at one point, twice actually, and banished, but he stood his ground. And because of it, we have orthodox formulations of the deity of Christ, the Trinitarian deity of Christ. And Athanasius says at one time about this text, who does not see that the brightness cannot be separated from the light, but that it is by nature proper to it and coexistent with it and is not produced after it? Heretics were saying, well, the glory emanates from Christ or from God the Father. Though the rays are Christ, the glory is actually God. And Athanasius says, you fools, you're twisting language. The glory is a right and true property of Christ. As Hugh says, to isolate the person of Christ from the work of Christ can only lead to distortion and error. A false doctrine of the person of Christ must inevitably result in a false doctrine of the work of Christ. You see this in cults all the time, don't you? You get the doctrine of Christ wrong, you get then false doctrine of the work of Christ too, if you get the person of Christ wrong. And Hugh says, consequently, you undermine the whole system of the gospel. You see this in every cult that gets the doctrine of Christ wrong. They get his work wrong too. Then also by saying Christ is the exact imprint, and if you have your Greek text before, you see that word charakter, right? Charakter, from which we get our word character. The idea of the exact imprint of his nature. The author is establishing his deity, his oneness with the Father. The principal idea is one of correspondence here, the idea of an exact imprint. The correspondence involves not only an identity of the essence of the Son with that of the Father, but also a true and trustworthy revelation or representation of the Father by the Son. Christ puts it this way in his own ministry. He who has seen me has seen the Father. You see the exact imprint of the Father in my life. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. Trinitarian implications here. Can you see why not only Athanasius, but the others had this text at their elbow at the Nicene Creed and formation of the Nicene, and all the creeds, great creeds of Christendom? Well, that is not the only thing he says here, our author of Hebrews. God also sustains all things through his word, does he not? The creation is not only made by him, but he is intimately involved in its providential course. This gives the lie to the deistic philosophy, right, that God wound up the world, created the world, and then wound it up like a watch and walked away from it, and it's ticking by natural law ever since. No. God is intimately, providentially involved in his world, in sustaining it. He doesn't sustain it like Atlas, right? As the Greek gods have him bearing a big burden on his shoulders as he trudges through the creation. No, he is not like Atlas bearing a burden. He is like a loving God, like a loving Father, intimately involved with it and providentially guiding our lives in the course of our lives as well. Declared all through the New Testament, does it not? That indeed God sustains all things through his words. By him, all things hold together, as Paul says in Colossians chapter 1. Well, this is not the only thing that our author says about Christ. He says in E under 2, Christ reigns in glorification after making purification. Now, these sections here in these tightly compacted in these first four verses are also foreshadowing major motifs, major themes that he's going to treat in depth throughout his letter. So when he talks about his making purification, what is he talking about? Of course, every Jewish listener to this sermon, it was it's postulated that these are a series of sermons that have been then compacted together in a letter, and that could well be. Everyone in his Jewish audience would understand the idea of purification, that is cleansing from sin, the labors of a priest. And of course, chapter after chapter deals with Christ and his priesthood, and his perfect priesthood, right? So he's foreshadowing Christ's labors as a priest, which he unpacks intimately throughout the later chapters. Let's look at chapter 9, for example, of Hebrews, just quickly to refresh our memories. Hebrews chapter 9, beginning at about verse 10. When Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things that have come, then through the greater and more perfect tent, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation, once again superior to this creation, he entered once for all into the holy places, not by means of the blood of goats and calves, but by means of his own blood, thus securing an eternal redemption. For if the sprinkling of defiled persons with the blood of goats and bulls and with the ashes of a heifer sacrifices for the purification of the flesh, how much more? Once again, see how much greater, more perfect the sacrifice of Christ, the labors of Christ are than those that come before in the old covenant. How much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, purify our conscience from dead works to serve the living God? The work of purification, previewed here, foreshadowed here. And after that, then, we have this euphemism for finished work. That is, he sat down at the right hand of God. We see this as a theme throughout the scriptures too. Psalm 110, we'll be preaching Psalm 110 during Easter season. How come that word is escaping me? Lent. Thank you. Thanks for lending me a hand. We'll be preaching through Psalm 110 during the period of Lent. But in Psalm 110, it begins with, "Sit thou at my right hand until I make thine enemies a footstool." The idea that you sit at the right hand of the power on high is that indeed you have finished work, but it doesn't mean your work, your labors are necessarily finished. It doesn't mean that he's chilling, if you will. No, he is still reigning in session. He is sitting at the right hand of the Father, and he is reigning now in session until indeed enemies are made his footstool. Then he will stand again, even as he does in the book of Revelation, and go out and take his inheritance, even as Caleb did, right? In his old age, Caleb and Joshua both went out. Just because they inherited their portion of the land doesn't mean their work was done. In fact, it started in a lot of ways because they had to go and drive out the enemies of Israel and take possession of it, even as Christ will take possession, stand one day and take possession of his inheritance as well, as he destroys his enemies, makes them a footstool. So Christ reigns in glorification now after making purification. And then finally, we see an F under 2. Christ is higher and superior to all created beings. Having become as much superior to angels as the name he has inherited is more excellent than theirs. When Edward the Fourth of Scotland became King of England, he had a name. He took another name, did he not? You know what that name was? Those of you holding a certain Bible in your laps know him by James, right? James the First. That's the name he inherited when he took possession of his inheritance. Christ has taken possession of his inheritance, and his name, that is Son, is higher. And he will establish this, the author. His name is much more excellent than theirs, because he is called the Son, having become as much superior to name to the angels as the name he has inherited is more excellent than theirs. And he will segue then to finish the chapter by making that point, will he not? So we will unpack that further next week. But you understand now that God has spoken, has he not? And he has used more than words to speak, even as we have seen we use all kinds of things besides words to speak. Well, his life has spoken, has it not? His first advent spoke eloquently to the people of Israel that indeed Messiah had come. And even as he lived his life before Israel, how do you live the law perfectly? You look to Christ, because in every situation of life, every situation that he faced, every situation that we might face as well, morally, spiritually, he performed perfectly. Did he not? And people began to see this one is not mere mortal. He is indeed bearing the exact imprint of his Father in glory. So, God is not silent. Indeed, he has spoken. Declare this not only to the ones you love, the ones to know him, but also to a blind, deaf, generation that does not hear him, that cannot hear him until indeed the word is ministered to them and used by the power of the Spirit to transform them. God is not silent. He has spoken, has he not? He has also spoken in his Son through the sacraments. Let us now come to that place where we see him speak, where we see him declare his death, burial, and resurrection in the simple elements of the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.